Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to speak. My hard drive crashed Monday, and I thought, oh, no problem, I'll go into the office and somebody will help me out. And then I called into the office, and they said that it had been evacuated because there was a gas leak in downtown Des Moines. So I took that as a sign that there would be no PowerPoint today. So, and a little bit about the Nature Conservancy. We're one of the nation's largest nonprofits. We've typically worked, a lot of us, and myself included, are ecologists, and so we work in wildlands. Ecologists are sort of the equivalent of agronomists, but we work in wild natural areas and study natural systems, and not working land systems. But I'm from a farm, and just about every male member of my family on both sides of the family are farmers, and so I've had it gravitated naturally toward agriculture and kind of bringing together my thoughts about ecology and agriculture. And one of the big questions has been, for a long time, you know, what is driving the increased size of our hypoxic zones? And especially in the light, from what I can tell, there haven't been any really dramatic increases in fertilizer application. So it got me to thinking, you know, what's really going on here? You know, we know a lot of the fertilizer application is sort of mass balance. You put in what you take out. And farmers, I think, naturally, especially when times are tough, are going to skimp on some of those inputs. There are a number of things we can do to increase nutrient use efficiency, but I really think there's a lot of other things going on, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. Back in the mid-1990s, my sort of thoughts about this started when I was working on the Iowa River on a big flood recovery project after the flood of 1993. The big question I had was, why are all of these farmers in the floodplain not able to crop their farms anymore? They're not crazy. At some point, they must have been able to crop these areas. And now we were in there doing massive buyouts of land along the river because they were getting flooded every year or every other year or every 3 years. And it was just not workable for them on the cropping system. I started looking into that, and I found a study on bridge aggradation done for the DOT. And there's a lot about sediment and other things, but one of the striking things that I saw was that prior to the 1970s, the Iowa River had a flow rate of 700 cubic feet per second. After the 1970s, it had about a 1,400 cubic feet per second flow rate. That's an average annual rate, and so that's double what it was in the previous 30 to 50 years. We found similar trends on the Boone River. We have a project on the Boone. We work with a number of partners across the Midwest on a variety of watershed projects. And on the Boone, we also had seen a 100% increase in flow rates on the river. And some people that have examined the Mississippi main stem have seen 40% increases in the main stem all the way down to Louisiana. And if you think about it, the nutrient targets set by EPA are to reduce nutrients by 45%, and that almost mirrors the increase in flow that you've seen. And the loss of nitrogen in particular, but also phosphorus in its sediment, is largely driven by water. If we didn't have a lot of water moving through the system, we wouldn't lose any nitrogen. And that occurs during drought years. You'll see very high water quality during droughts. And that's just because those nutrients aren't being pushed out of the system. So water is the driver, and that's one of the points I wanted to get across today. So then logically the question becomes, well, what's causing this large increase in water flow? Immediately, a lot of environmentalists will point to drainage tile. But, I mean, if you think about it, the drainage system actually creates something like a storm basin. The area above the tile is actually a storage area for water. So as soon as that's drained out, it becomes a storage area. And so it's not as straightforward. I think tile does increase base flow, but it's a little trickier when you start looking at storm flows. And again, I'm going to get back to prior to the 1970s. I think one of the reasons for the doubling of the water flow is that we've changed our cropping systems. If you look at old maps, and I've got one from a which I would have liked to have shown here, but I've got a map of Iowa, north central Iowa, from a pheasant study that ran from the 1940s to the 1970s. And what's striking about the map of that area in Winnebago County is that only about 40% of the fields were row cropped. It was corn back in the 1940s and 50s. And by the 70s, thanks to soybeans and the loss of livestock and so on, it had become about 90% row crop. A lot of people like to blame corn, but it's actually the addition of soybeans into the rotation that caused some of that. That's significant because when you don't have living roots and growing plants on the landscape for a significant period of time, you basically from May to August you've got living plants, but for the rest of the year you don't. And that really shifts the evapotranspiration rate. And a lot of people like to focus on rivers, but if the bulk, 70% of the water that falls in a watershed leaves through the air. I like to call it rivers in the sky. Because they're invisible, people totally discount that, but evapotranspiration is probably, the loss of evapotranspiration is probably one of the reasons that we see more water in our rivers and more flooding and those sorts of things. And so that's one cause. That was probably a cause that affected our systems from the 1950s to the 70s. But from the 70s on, and this is from a paper that Mark Tomer of ARS and Keith Schilling from the University of Iowa put together, they found that ET was probably a driver before the 70s, but then climate became the driver after that. We're getting increasing precipitation, as much as 10% more precipitation, but the big trigger, I think, is the fact that we get very large events. And those of you that work in ag fields, I think, realize this. Instead of 1-inch rains, we get 3- and 4-inch rains. And even worse than that, you know, the Root River, they had, an event that was 12 or 14 inches. Those events are the things that really move nutrients. And in the Great Lakes, for instance, between 1976 and 1995 on the Maumee River, just 23 storms accounted for 32% of the phosphorus loss. So oftentimes we plan in soil and water conservation on average conditions, and you're planning to manage for average conditions, but it's the big events like that really blow out all of the nutrients and things, and I think we start to need to plan for these extremes. But I think the point I wanted to get across most of all, and this is a simplification of the whole system, but we need strategies to deal with and to manage water and nutrients. I think the focus is oftentimes on the nutrients because that's what people see in the water, but it's the hidden flows and so on that are driving all of the nutrients into the water, and I think we need to start managing for water. You can do that with the 4 R's. I'm not going to get into too much detail because I think Carrie is going to coming up next is going to be talking about 4 R's a little bit, but you can manage rate and timing and the form and placement of a fertilizer to avoid some of the impacts of water. It's a different way of looking at it, but if you apply your fertilizer with the knowledge of what is going to happen with rainfall and so on, and honestly you can't anticipate that, but you know if you put it on later in the season it's less likely to be lost. I think I just read recently that early season rainfall is probably one of the largest predictors of limit or the largest limiters on nitrogen fertilizer. And so if you can put that fertilizer on later when the plant needs it, I think that's going to help a lot. Soil health is another way that you can manage for water. Hugh Hammond Bennett, the founder of NRCS, often referred to the reservoir of the soil. And soil organic matter is a tremendous reservoir for water. Can't remember the exact statistics, but you know, a pound of soil organic matter can hold several pounds of water or gallons of water. And things like cover crops that are often touted as soil management techniques also dramatically increase evapotranspiration, as I talked about earlier. And one thing that I'm particularly interested in is drainage water management. Our drainage systems have sort of short-circuited the normal flow of water. It used to take decades for water to leave the landscape, and now it takes days. However, I think you can easily mitigate for some of that by using some of the techniques that have been developed by Mr. Janes of ARS. The saturated buffers are one of my favorites. Down south, they use the tailwater recovery systems. Closed-loop drainage systems, I think, are another opportunity. Two-stage ditches, and then small wetland catchments that catch tile water and treat it. All of those techniques increase the residence time and allow for biological activity to break down nitrates and other things. And they're very effective, too. There's oftentimes 50% greater reductions in nitrates with those drainage techniques. So, in conclusion, I guess what the takeaway I'd like to give you is that I think we need, I mentioned this earlier, we need to manage for water and nutrients. There are groups out there that are, the drainage community is getting into this. Company I'm aware of, Ecosystem Services Exchange, is very much interested in helping people with innovative drainage systems. I think groups like yours should also probably be supporting the long-term agriculture research program, the LTAR of the ARS. I think that a lot of these problems cannot be solved unless we have long-term research, and I think that's a very important program. I'm helping with this, and the American Society of Agriculture and Biological Engineers, or ASABI, is going to be putting on an international drainage conference next year here in Minneapolis. I think that's in September. Dan, do you remember the date? September. September of next year, be held right here in Minneapolis, and you can learn a lot about some of the drainage water techniques there. There's also Minnesota and Iowa, the drainage engineers get together every year. I think November 23rd, they're going to have a meeting in Owatonna. So there's lots of opportunities to learn about this stuff. And I guess another thing that you can do is to support the land grants universities and their work with drainage systems. There's an extension group that Dr. Jane Frankenberger of Purdue is leading that is looking into innovative drainage systems. And I guess finally, that I think drainage and water management provide an opportunity to improve yields and profit, and also to create tremendous benefits for water quality. An often quoted statistic that Charlie Schaefer from Ragged Drain uses is that 60% of the yield variability in crops is due to either too much or too little water. And I think for too long we we've used too simple of systems to manage this water. I think we need to become more intelligent and to put a lot more effort and research into how to manage water differently, because I think it's vital for agronomics, but also for the environment. So do I take questions now or later?
Now would be
great. Okay. Yeah, how much time do I have?
We have 15 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm happy to answer questions. One thing I didn't talk about very much was the Nature Conservancy, and we are working in agriculture more than people realize. We have projects across the Midwest, across the country. And if you're interested in partners for projects, a lot of our folks are available. We'd like to work with agronomists and soil scientists because that's not our forte. Like I mentioned, a lot of us are ecologists, but I think these various disciplines need to start working together if we're going to come up with realistic solutions.
Dave, one question I'd throw at you is the engineering world is used to working with managing water quantity, mm-hmm. Very much so when it comes to flood flows. What I'm looking at is smaller, a lot more frequent events. Are you thinking the solution comes from the world of attending this conference, or do you think it's going to be because the flood control people start looking at more frequent sized storms?
This is a discussion that goes way back to the 1930s, that there's a great speech by Hugh Hammond Bennett on the NRCS website, where Hugh, who was a soils guy, you know, one of the first soils people out there, he makes the argument to the, he made an argument to a group of civil engineers that managing soil was just as important as building dams. And I guess I tend to be more on his side, although I recognize that NRCS has used dams very effectively to control flooding in small watersheds. I think there's a lot to be done with sort of the soft engineering, maybe is what you'd call it, managing soil, managing plants. I mean, just because it's not mechanical doesn't mean it's not effective. We tend to believe, I think we put a lot more weight on mechanical fixes to things when biological fixes are as effective. I guess that's where I look at it. But, I mean, I'd welcome working with engineers. In my family, if you're not a farmer, you're an engineer. So I get that way of looking at things. And I think engineers have a lot to offer.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, Carrie.
Can you talk about the Nature Conservancy position, if they have one on grain tile? And I know you recently had an interesting experience with probably the government here.
I don't know that we have a position on it. Drainage systems are absolutely vital and important to the production of crops. I'm probably biased. My brothers and I own some farmland, and I know when the drainage tile breaks that it creates a huge mess, and we get out and fix it right away. And it's enabled the cropping of large expanses of the upper Midwest. I also like wetlands, obviously, too, so I think there are ways to incorporate wetland systems into drainage systems, either as to recirculate drainage water. You know, oftentimes we get rid of all the water in the spring, and then we find in August that you need rain. You know, that's where we lose a lot of yield in a lot of years. And I don't know that we have a position, but I personally am interested in working with the drainage community. I think they've been very open to that. They're interested in innovation and, you know, figuring this out. But the Nature Conservancy, by its nature, is a collaborative organization. Environmental organizations are often either collaborative or confrontational, and I'm not saying either one is better than the other, but you can't be both. So we are in the collaborative camp, and I think I'm very interested in working with drainage groups. Did I mention everything you wanted me to mention? Oh, yeah. I was telling Carrie about a smoking tile demonstration that really kind of blew my mind. I'm sorry I can't remember the name of the guy. He used to work for NRCS, but he blows smoke literally up a tile system. And this field we were in, it was no-tilled and had cover crops on it. And I could not believe how connected via wormholes that the surface was to the tile. And those are tight soils. I was shocked. I looked at the soil pit that he dug. There was no A horizon in that, in the Western Lake Erie Basin field we were standing in. And so drainage is very important. But again, getting back to the biological stuff, the worms, which nobody had to pay anything for, you provide them no-till and cover crops, obviously, are good for earthworms. But those worms were providing conduits for the water to get into the tile system and were probably much enhancing that system. It created great enhancement to drainage systems. And so I think, again, there's a way to combine the biological and the engineering and to come up with better solutions. But, if you ever get a chance to, sorry, I can't remember his name, but the...
Frank Gibbs?
Yeah, that's probably right. The smoking tile demonstration is really awesome.
Sorry, Dave, I missed the first part of your presentation. I've been focusing mostly on the upper Midwest region. Just wondered about the Nature Conservancy and working in other parts of the country. I'm from the western U.S., and we have plenty of water quality challenges, but very different than the Mississippi Basin. But just wondered the activities of the Nature Conservancy throughout the country, if you could address that.
Okay. I can talk about a few. I've been out to, we're working in the west slope of the, in the Colorado River Basin. There, the issue is lack of water. And in the west, the problem is often lack of water. Water quality, yes, is another concern. But and we have some interesting projects over there. We've got a project in California at Staten Island. It's a 9,000-acre cornfield. In fact, it's probably the largest cornfield in California, and we own and manage it. The reason it's that way is that half the population of sandhill cranes winters in that field, and so it's important for them to have that source of carbohydrates, and so corn's one of the better sources of that. But, you know, the Staten Island folks are very interested in agriculture. Guys we have projects in Idaho, Colorado. A lot of them are working at irrigation. I think we're interested in innovative irrigation systems out there and working with that industry. There are a lot of confounding issues in the West. There are oftentimes not incentives to conserve water. If it's a use it or lose it system based on the old water laws, and so that makes it difficult to convince people to save water. We've got to come up with better policy mechanisms to, like water banks are one way that farmers can save water and not lose their rights to the water.
You mentioned being interested in collaborating with agronomists and soil scientists. Could you elaborate a little bit more about what the Nature Conservancy brings to the table in those type of collaborations with agronomists and soil scientists?
Okay. Well, first off, we specialize in nonprofit fundraising, so we oftentimes bring money to the table. That's one thing that a lot of people are interested in. I guess we understand collaborations. If you work with nonprofits, you'll find that they have to be collaborative to get anything done. We oftentimes don't have the resources or expertise to do what needs to be done, and so we're always looking for partners. And so that comes easy to us. I guess we also look at it, I mentioned earlier, from the standpoint of an ecologist. So we might look at the system differently and come up with a new and creative idea to do something. There may be some innovation benefits to working with us. I think that's off the top of my head. Those are some of the things that we would bring to the table. We also bring staff to the table too. We oftentimes will hire people to work out in the field with producers, because that's the thing that's missing most often, is there's not a personal contact person to work with producers. And we've got staff working out of USDA offices and other offices out in the field. A lot of our people are not in cities. They're literally out in the countryside. And so that's another thing that we're good at, I think.
You talked about innovative around drainage and irrigation. I'm from Ontario. We have a big sand plain, and there's been some work on subsurface drip irrigation. And I've never been a supporter of irrigating row crops, at least in an Ontario context. But it's interesting to me, because if we can hold that water through the spring when you need to get it off the plant, especially in those droughty soils, but even in a lot of our loams and clays, we have a water deficit later in the season, and it'd be nice to be able to retain that, push it back up into the system. I've heard no talk or seen no talk about SDI and that type of thing here at ASA this time.
Yeah, I think it needs to be talked about more. I think one of the reasons it's not is it doesn't quite pencil out in a lot of cases. Although down in the Mississippi Delta, they're using tailwater recovery systems like crazy. They love them. They get 50 or 60 inches of rain down there, but it comes at the wrong time. And so, you know, they can capture a lot of that runoff in the spring and hold it in the pond, and then they've got irrigation systems to recirculate that. And, in a drought year, the benefits are phenomenal. There was a guy in Illinois that we helped set up a system with. It was a drought back a few years back. I think it was 2007 or 8 or something like that. But in Illinois, his neighbors had yields of 110 bushels an acre, and he was at about 220. And so if you start looking at the long term, I think those systems start to pencil out where they should. Probably works better at $7 corn than $3 corn, but I think as you know, there's only so much land, and we've got to come up with ways to produce more crops per acre because there's going to be an increasing demand and no more land. And so I think drainage and irrigation systems are something that's going to be a thing of the future. Okay. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay, please remember that we are live streaming. There may be questions that come in at which time Jared, the technician back there, will be able to go back there. But I need you to speak into the microphone so that the people that are online can hear the question. I think all your mics are on. Is this correct, Jared? Okay. So you should be fine up there. So just to help you out, these are our morning panelists. Remember, Carrie, this is Jay from the Mosaic Company, but everybody else is represented up there. So if you have a question, raise your hand. I'll come and give you the mic.
This question is probably for Jeff, but after hearing the Crow Wing County experience, how do you see this level of planning migrate to other parts of the state where maybe you don't have that density of water resources that people really, really, really care about?
Well, I think the scale does matter. And I think there are places and things that people do care about in all of those areas. It's a matter of trying to elicit those things. There are areas to protect all across the state of Minnesota. There are resources and maybe water resources, habitat resources that people care about. And I think the smaller scale allows that to filter to the top. And see how that works out from moving in some of the counties to the south of Crow Wing, in the transition zone, Todd County, for instance, is experimenting with this thing sort of process and see how that works out. But I think it's a matter of trying to find resources that people care about. It's a little bit like Velcro. We find enough hooks for folks to grab onto and go figure out a way to be part of the process.
I have a question for Dana. Can you talk a little bit about conservation priorities and if they're set at what level, what the level that they're at?
Yes, well, obviously we get our money from the federal government, but there is a lot of local buy-in. We've talked a lot about those partnerships and the local soil and water conservation districts and all of our local offices. And all of our local offices, be it a county or a work unit, which is a grouping of counties, they all have stakeholders. And those stakeholders are supposed to meet at least annually to talk about the priorities. And it's really going to depend on what they have going on in the counties, what the land uses are. There may be a county that is heavily focused on forestry or 100% cropland. And then they look at what the resource concerns are. Is nutrient management and water quality that's a result of nutrient management going to be their primary priority for that year's funding, and then they are able to, in some amount, to adjust where they are going to prioritize the local spending of their EQIP, which is the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, at a local level. And so we do have a national requirement that we spend 60% of those dollars on livestock related practices, whether that is waste related or livestock management. And so that's the only limitation, but other than that, at a local level, they can set those priorities within reason. Sometimes the states, for political or other reasons, may override somewhat a local decision if it was something that just didn't make sense and there wasn't a rationale for it. but usually the local group work unit or county would have a lot of a large role in planning, deciding what the priorities would be. Kind of long.
Got another question for you. I'm listening to Carrie's talk, and I'm seeing a lot of howitzers. I mean, big, big, big corporate interests. And I think it's great. And I'm looking at the size of the scale that Dave started out with talking about. You know, we're talking 40% reductions type of thing. And I guess this question is both for Bruce and Dane, as far as, like, at the federal level, Dana, I'm seeing NRCS and EPA kind of flopping around a little bit about how to deal with the Gulf of Mexico, and kind of different messages from each agency. And at the state level, Bruce is just outlining this great stuff, but still, we're not scaling up very quickly. I'm thinking a lot of the solution really is going to end up coming from the world that Terry was describing. I'm just kind of curious how you two would respond to this comment.
Okay, I'll take the first shot at it. First, I'd like to really emphasize, I think the role of Minnesota dealers is going to be huge. We've been meeting with Minnesota crop production retailers, for example, over the last 6 to 8 months, talking about what their role in environmental stewardship is going to be and how they might actually help and, you know, how they can develop an environmental program way beyond what they're doing right now. And they're looking for tools, and we'll hear a little bit more about some of the assessments later this afternoon. But I don't think we're ever going to be successful unless we bring private, you know, industry to play here. The issue is far, far too large. We could never afford enough either soil and water district or state people to respond to this. It has to be a partnership with the dealerships and the industry to make this whole thing work. So hopefully we'll move forward with that, Steve. You know, I think the attitude toward the industry has changed a lot in the last 5 to 10 years, and they're looking for being part of the solution.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that it's a big enough challenge that it's going to require all of the moving parts to work together, from industry to state, federal. Everyone will have to work together. And I work with the EPA folks across the mall from me, and that's one of the relationships I've really been trying to build, because I am a huge fan of voluntary activity rather than getting into that regulatory activity. Just from my own farm background, I know my father always curses the federal government, including myself, for the regulations that we set. He does it, and a lot of farmers don't understand the difference between the different agencies, and that some are there trying to push that voluntary aspect. But I think it will definitely require partnerships and building on that. And I wish Laura was still here from the Fertilizer Institute, because they've really been very helpful at trying to build those relationships between the different federal agencies and state agencies and industry and the ag retailers. And when it comes to something like nutrient management planning, looking to the ag retailers and the crop consultants are really the boots on the ground that we're going to need to make it happen, because we just don't have, as a state employee, the Soil and Water Conservation District, the NRCS staff, to be able to put all of that conservation in place. So it's just going to require an effort. And I agree, there has been a lag. It seems like we're kind of floundering. And from an NRCS perspective, my predecessor retired 2 years ago. It took 2 years for this position to be filled. And so I'm excited to get involved, and reading through different states' nutrient reduction strategies is really where I see a starting point. I'm not just throwing money at projects, which are very worthwhile, but really having the ability to concentrate those efforts in priority watersheds.
All right, my turn. This is probably more important.
there's been any conversation from the Board of Water and Soil Resources to outside entities about this type of approach to watershed management.
So far, the main expansion and interest we've seen has been within the forest itself and out in north central Minnesota, especially the upper Mississippi Basin. As I think Mitch mentioned, there is a 8-county joint powers board that was established in 1980 over the first 400 miles of the Mississippi River. It's not the basin, but a narrow corridor that makes up that first 400 miles. However, there are regular monthly meetings of this 8-county board. They represent 40 county commissioners of north central Minnesota. Potentially, that's a very powerful, useful body if they decide to engage in some serious water quality protection efforts. And so what it looks like is going to happen, and it's certainly our goal, is for each of those 8 counties to have a plan, a county water plan similar to Crowley's. Hubbard counties is now just being completed, and we have Aiken, Cass, Clearwater, and Beltrami counties they're all interested in a similar type process. So we're hoping we can have those 8 counties across that first 400 miles sort of speaking the same language, and that is minor watershed context. And the other thing I should have mentioned earlier in my comments was it's kind of all about, with the referendum money available, whether it be habitat or clean water, it's about identifying priorities you can defend. So when someone says, why should we fund you, it's like you can't wait because you're ready. And you've got your data, and you've got your facts, and people go, well, these folks have done the homework. They know what they're doing. Let's fund them. And so that we're hoping to see protection dollars going north.
For my 2 cents, I think that particularly like the last part where we talked about the sensitivity and the foster sensitivity and thinking about targets, those are all going to work their way into the watershed restoration and protection strategies, the major watershed practices, I think, around the state, and those things will be highlighted that way.
I have one more question for Bruce, with the first of opening up a can of worms. I have heard, through your grapevine, that there was just a buffer law passed here in Minnesota. How does that affect what you were talking about, or does it at all?
Well, if you read the media, there's a real strong language about commonly things get to go a little haywire in the media. In terms of buffers, more than likely from a groundwater perspective, it's going to be pretty minimal. Even though buffers frequently have good continuous vegetative cover, which we absolutely love, I mean, that's why we're optimistic that cover crops or living cover mulches, I mean, anything that we can do to change the water balance because of that key fall and spring recharge, you know, and that's when the fireworks happens in terms of nitrate leaching loss. It's not during the cropping season, it's during the non-cropping season when that happens. But in terms of actual impact of the buffers onto nitrates, probably is going to be fairly minor. Now, some areas like the Vermilion in Dakota County, some of these areas, if where surface water is connected to groundwater, there we might have some very positive impacts.
Yeah, when I lived and worked here, I was the co-watershed person with John Jansky on the Vermilion River, and I know that we had problems with nitrates back then, too. Anybody?
So probably for Bruce, this summer there was an article in the Star Tribune, I think, talked about a community in southern Minnesota that, I guess their views were that they would accept their high nitrate contamination as just the cost of And so you mentioned that in some areas, best management practices may not quite be enough. And so with the thought in mind that some of these communities really don't want to change anything, they'll just accept their high groundwater nitrates and treat it, how will you approach that, or how will the state approach that? Suggest that you take it out of production or different crops, just go with it and let them treat it?
Great question. I think the community you're referring to is Edgerton. That's one of our real small community water suppliers. The acreage is extraordinarily small. We've done some partnership work at that site where we actually, the city actually cost shared the grower to take it out of production. And you talked about things going haywire quickly. In that particular case, and that was about 10 years ago, they actually paid the grower to fallow the ground, not put anything on it, and the nitrate levels actually got considerably worse. And when you look at it from a scientific perspective, you understand why that happened. I mean, living crops are there to take up the nitrogen that comes from the mineralization, the natural nitrogen that's going to be released. So we have to apply science to this whole thing. But to get to your question specifically, how we would deal with it as a department, if it's a public water supply, and there's many people involved with this, which most source water protection areas are, we would highly encourage, particularly in a small area like Edgerton, just to think seriously about getting land tied up in CRP or some type of a continuous vegetative system. That's probably one of the most surefire ways we're going to be able to knock those nitrates down in a reasonable amount of time. When we move into some of these townships, we're going to find a lot of communities aren't just ready to take them down. There's way many other things that they're going to try to deal with. So we're going to have to kind of sort out which communities are going to be ready to go and truly want to make a difference here, because there's going to be far more areas to work on than we ever are going to have enough human resources to deal with it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Good.
Any other questions? Well, what I'd like to ask the panel to do at this point is to take a minute or two and talk about, with respect to what we're talking about here today, the issues, challenges, and promising solutions, the things that come to the forefront of your mind as to what is important, what needs to happen, and those opportunities. And I know that could be a dissertation in and of itself, but what comes to mind first as things to work on?
I can start to say that we'll get, it just seems like listening to the other speakers, we're becoming more of a data-rich environment every day, and I'm a data junkie, I like maps, and I think the Clean Water Legacy Amendment really kind of put the impetus on the locals and the state folks to say, okay, now that we're giving this money, let's spend it in a wise manner, and to do that, we need to, again, defend it, and how do you do that? We need to start adding more monitoring sites. You look at the data that you have and find out, well, where's the gaps, and maybe the scale becomes a main issue and you need to drill down more. So I think that's the takeaway across the board here is that we're becoming more of a data-rich environment. Let's keep focusing on that.
I would add that data-rich is great, but at some point in time we have to successfully communicate with the public on what it means. So this whole concept of performance indicators and effectively communicating with different audiences and with legislation or legislators is really going to be the key. So having these funds is absolutely great, but then we need to figure out some clear messaging so they fully appreciate the complexity that we're trying to deal with.
One of the things that stands out for me is obviously nutrient management planning and just continuing that awareness of the 4R nutrient stewardship idea, and to get that information so that it becomes common practice when farmers and crop consultants, when we're doing nutrient management applications, that we're using this for ours as the driver for how we're applying. And also, I heard this about a year ago. It's really about nutrient loss reduction rather than nutrient reduction. And I think that that's really important, and I think that Carrie said this morning, I mean, farmers need fertilizers to get a yield. So fertilizers aren't going to go away. So we just really need to increase that awareness of how to apply them, when to apply them, and what to apply, and get that to be a priority rather than just saying farmers need to use less fertilizer.
I think depending on whether you're talking about groundwater or surface water, you can start to talk about different problems and confuse the issue a little bit for citizens. You're talking about nitrates as a different animal than phosphorus, which is a different animal than sediment. And maybe as we start to think about dissolved phosphorus and some of these systems and its effects on some of these downstream lakes and reservoirs. And so I think clarity of message at some point needs to come to the forefront so that we can the fun bass and the other F1s that Carrie talked about this morning, but being able to have that information in an acceptable fashion that people can understand and think about acting on as they act on it, and they can see what their part is. If it looks like it's hopeless, then there's less interest in making part of it.
I rarely miss an opportunity to beat the drum for protection. And so I just want to say it's very encouraging to see a protection strategy emerging in Minnesota, where we've got a lot of protecting to do. We all know it's most cost effective, and we can't really afford not to in the long run. Just hats off to Crow Wing County for stepping out and going down this path, and now the other counties in North Central are picking up on that and moving in that direction. We can do protect habitat and water quality at the same time, and that's where we perhaps stack public benefits the highest, and that's where the resources should go.
Okay, thank you to all of our panelists this morning, and we are going to break for lunch at this point. We'll be back here at 1:05 with some more speakers coming up. What I put up on the screens for you are this afternoon's panelists, so that you can kind of remember who they all are. I'm going to open it up for questions, and then near the end I'm going to ask them all for a final statement on this topic, something to think about as you leave the conference today. Any questions?
So this is for anyone, even including the audience, as we come from all different states. But are there any states that are determining acceptable levels of nutrient runoff at the edge of field on farms that are too small to be as a point source? And if not, are there any countries that are regulating nutrient runoff?
Well, all farms in the U.S. of A are exempt from the Clean Water Act, so unless a state has enacted a specific regulation about, the farm runoff by definition is non-point source, at least the way the courts have determined it thus far. There are other standards that may be in place, but I'm not aware of any in our neighboring states. And Shannon, I don't know any more about it in Minnesota. There really aren't any specific field edge or even larger requirements, I'm aware.
No, I would just echo what John said about kind of the regulatory landscape in the U.S. There's certainly best practice kind of research that's done and information that's available, but as far as in a regulatory framework, I'm not aware of anything in the U.S. or actually beyond the U.S.
I will say this is a bit heated to elaborate, but one of the rationale, or one of the gets out of the ag water quality certification is that you get the idea that people can see you as a good producer for potential marketable reasons, but you also get a 10-year commitment that the state's not going to enact a new regulation on something that currently isn't. So, you know, I mean, it's a preventative measure to sort of, you know, with the idea that regulations could come but isn't here now.
Yeah, to that point too, I think our program is trying to deal with the fact that regulation, like the work we're doing, putting conservation professionals out there, is really expensive, it's really time consuming. In our division, particular division at the Department of Ag, we have fertilizer pesticide regulators, and that is a full-time business that requires a lot of staff, a lot of resources to do. So our approach is, can we get the same results by incentivizing?
I have a question for Mark. You have a convincing talk on climate change, and you were talking about agriculture there. And what I see is a lot of people either not knowing what to do to prepare or thinking they're just going to be reactive to it. So is there a proactive thing that producers and farmers should be looking at, or is there anything that they can do to wait out the storm, so to speak?
In our own setting in Minnesota, and I can't speak for other states, the Agri-Growth Council only in recent years, which is all the big players in agriculture in Minnesota, now has the climate change and its challenges on their agenda, even at the top level. So it's getting legs as an issue with the leadership in agriculture. It's taken a long time to get there, but I think we'll see some more progress in that direction, certainly more community dialogue in the agricultural community. I think that's been a sea change. It's taken most of my lifetime here to see that sea change, but I think it's underway now. And so from the standpoint of strategies, dialogue associated with the future, I think we'll be hearing a lot more about it. I don't know what that will look like, but Minnesota might turn out, you know, our Minnesota culture is one where we have a history of waiting to see what others do about something. And this might be a case where Minnesota might actually get out in the lead on some of this, I don't know, relative to some other states. Because we've got some powerful leadership in the state of Minnesota with respect to American agriculture. So I hope I see that happen.
Don, I want to kind of follow up a little bit on it, because I have a question for you too, Mark. At the very start of your talk, you threw in this little line about we continually underestimate how much this is changing. Are these models showing that at some point it's going to kind of level off, and we should say, instead of counting on 20 inches of precipitation, we should just jump right up and say, all right, let's assume it's going to be 32 in 20 years and plan for that, or do we just keep playing catch up?
Yeah, the distressing notion for me as I come to the end of my career is that although 10, 20 years ago, the climate modeling community projected a level of change that was startling and highly problematic to strategize about and respond to. The data side, the measurement side of the climate game, which is what I've been in, the data are changing faster in some respects than the models even suggested they would. So that's very disconcerting, because we're now, as I said in my concluding remarks, with each passing year, at least in our neck of the woods, now this isn't universally true, but where we live and care about the landscape, we're seeing changes occur at a phenomenal pace, and we're more and more measuring attributes of our climate that we have not measured in our historical database. And that's very disturbing. For example, in one 10-year period, My first Minnesota Weather Almanac was produced by Minnesota Historical Society Press in 2005. In the 10 years that have transpired, the second edition, which was just released in April of this year, over 16,000 individual climate records were set in the 10 years, and over 150 state records, all-time state records, were set just in the last 10 years. If you look at that pace of change and you go back 160 years, it's just unbelievable. And I don't think we're going to plateau. I mean, I don't think you and I, in our lifetime, are going to see any leveling now of some of these changes. I think they're going to continue for a while.
Thank you.
My question is for Margaret. During your presentation, you indicated that your planning professional was a technical service provider and a retired Soil and Water Conservation District employee. So he's obviously familiar with the NRCS conservation planning process. And I was just curious, for professional reasons, if there was one reason or main reason why you did not use the NRCS planning process during your planning procedures.
I don't know the answer to that question specifically. Thinking about the planning team that pulled this together, he is familiar with that process, and I think as they went out and tested some of these procedures, the feedback that they got was keep it simple, keep it to, you know, a day in the field, and it was really the way that the process evolved was based on a lot of that feedback of what the farmers were looking for as far as an output in that report. So I think as we continue this and continue to work on it, that's a good point. How can we use many of the resources that already exist? I guess the take home for us was a really simple process that was easy to follow, and for some of the producers, we know that they're looking for some practices that they can fund themselves, and so not necessarily looking to fund all of the conservation practices through an input process. So one of our goals is to create kind of a list of options where they can. We want to direct them to the NRCS office and work through EQIP. In other cases, we know that they want to do some of this work themselves, some of the engineering work, and work maybe outside of some of the government programs. So I guess it's in some ways a local response to the individual farmers that we're working with and some of the assistance they are asking for.
Yeah, I just ask because we are always trying to kind of evolve our planning process and update our resource assessment, and we are actually going through some updates to our resource assessment. So we're always looking for feedback as to if there are specific stumbling blocks to using our tools and using our process. So any feedback would be appreciated.
Thanks.
I'd like to follow up a little bit on my question back here. Not just more a comment than a question, but I was super delighted to see Mark at these trends up front and visible. Back in my younger days, I was ready to completely throw out that 30-year normal stuff and go to a trend average, because in agriculture, if we get more precision in our models that support management decisions, we really need to look ahead at what the next season is likely to be. And the trend average is so much better than that in a 30-year normal. We know that thing is 15 years out of date when it's published. So just getting the public to think, I'm convinced now we just can't throw away the normal 30-year normal, but maybe just put out a trend average in addition to is what we expect the trend to give us next year. And sure, there's some climate cycles in the data, but if we keep making it visible, maybe we'll get some money to look at those cycles a little closer and look at the trend. But generally, most of the trends Mark is showing, we're going to stay in the direction they're going. Some of the agriculture people want to say, like, some of our yield trends are going up at a slower rate. Well, that's hooks. Your trend is still going up in spite of all this, but it's some point, climate change is going to hurt us. And as far as getting the regulations into this, the nice thing I see over my career, and parallels Mark's career very much, is what some of the food industry people are doing to get this into the counters at the stores so the consumers can vote. Can vote in something that's documented that comes from a sustainable production place and it comes from practices where they do conservation. That could be a very, very effective and powerful tool we see in the next few years around that area. In New York, it's taken on very well. And, our big food industry, Walmart, ways to have its farm-to-market trace put on the package. So that when you're out shopping for green beans, you can pick the ones that have a good label on them. There's nothing like voting with your pocketbook in your beef. Thank
you. One thing I would say about what our farmers are doing in terms of response to climate change, in Minnesota, they're putting in a lot more tile. Because they don't think, like Dr. Sibley does, in decades, they're thinking, pay off the investment terms, which are typically, much shorter than decades. However, there is a potential in that, too. Because they're doing that for predictability. They need predictability. As you upscale your operation in terms of size and all of that, predictability becomes a huge variable. And the one hope in that is that because of that, there is potential for more soil health practices to be incorporated. So you got a tile line underneath the field. You, as a producer, should be doing some other things then to reinvigorate your soil, better tillage practices or less tillage, things like cover crops and other ways to reinvigorate your soil that can provide both atmospheric benefits, water quality benefits, and production benefits. But we've had a heck of a time getting that scaled up in Minnesota thus far. I do think that is something that we can be doing in addition to the more predictable things that people are doing in infrastructure.
Does that work? Yeah, there we go. John, I was curious, you made a comment, I believe I heard this correctly, you were talking about late trends and improvements. And you made a comment about how the rate of improvement in soil water quality improvement would change with reduction in tillage. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more about that.
Well, you can look at it. I was just up in Red River Valley Monday and Tuesday. Yeah. We know that wind erosion is actually the biggest erosion factor in that part of the state. But we also know that the water quality models don't factor that in because they don't have a way to account for all that soil blowing off the land and guess where it goes. Gravity puts it in the lowest spot in the land, and that's in the river creek's ditches. And what we see up there is variable. One landowner in the same landscape's got tillage practices, minimum tillage, others nothing at all, no cover. The whole winter, water quality problems are going to result. You can't get around that in any way, shape, or form. So it's very expensive to put in structural practices, even though we've been able to, get them down to templates that are very efficiently designed and delivered, it's still, per acre basis of treatment, much more expensive than doing good tillage practices across a broad landscape, in my opinion. But we have to get people to change their thought about that, change their equipment too. So it is expensive to somebody. The landowner has to, the producer, the renter, whoever it is, has to change their ways. And more of them are seeing the benefits of that, but it's how do you get it up to scale instead of being 5% or 10%? How do you get it to 60% to 80%?
Is there any specific research on farmers? I sit and listen to soil fertility. There's no leading soil fertility specialists at U of M. My favorite quote from one of them was "No till, no corn," and that's a tough mindset to get
you know, people pass, and sometimes that's a generational mindset. How do you envision driving change of that?
Well, it'll be some combination of three tools: persuasion, money, and make them do it. You know, that's our future. We've got to figure out that package. I don't have the answer. And the regulations that I agree that that's the option of last resort by and large. However, when it's causing harm to someone else, then that's probably the first place he's trying to do it, where it's, you know, it's hard to do because, you know, you can't put a water trough at every section corner and watch people farm. We know that. So we have to figure out better ways to do it. I don't think that's necessary, but I do think more them understanding how it can benefit them personally and the long-term view. And maybe there's some creative ways to give some credit for some of that on a broader basis for atmospheric benefits or water quality benefits, something that could be, you know, given back to them as a token of their contribution to the greater good. That could be an idea. I don't know. I don't have the answer. I wish I did. Go to the conference next year, wherever else, and learn how others are doing it, I guess.
If I could just add that too, you know, I do think, and this has come up and it came up in your comments earlier, that there are opportunities to harness kind of the consumer side of market forces, whether it is the direct consumer or kind of the bigger corporations that have sustainability offices. They have a marketing campaign around those types of topics, and I think that's where and Peter had mentioned that ag water quality certification being one avenue for providing that marketing and providing that certification to show and demonstrate kind of more sustainable approaches, even from a consumer product standpoint or from a marketing standpoint. And I think the potential for that is just starting to be identified and thought about. You know, we've seen it in the forest practices, and I think we're starting to see the potential maybe for that in agricultural practices as well. But that's just one of the tools that are
going to help. And we're getting to the end here, so I'm going to kind of circle around to where we started this morning, and that was with Steve talking about partnerships and how important they are. And Steve, you're the nonprofit sitting up there. And so I'm wondering how you look upon partnerships and who you look to partnership with the membership that you have in the Freshwater Society.
There are industry groups and nonprofits and agencies we love to partner with. There are industry groups, nonprofits, and agencies I wouldn't turn my back on. The point is, partnering is hard. We said this morning that it's harder to work with others than by yourself. And so part of this is coming down to work with people you trust, because invariably, as you start working with somebody, we're on a couple of different task forces with the Department of Agriculture. We've had unnamed groups kind of go, well, why do you want to work on that? Why do you want to work with them? The last thing the Department of Ag wants out of us is to go, oh yeah, you're right, we quit. You know, cut and run, to quote Jesse Ventura, which you didn't think would happen today. The point is, and I don't mean to sound flippant here, but it's like, if you can't go and like have a beer with this person, why the hell, why would you want to get into a work relationship where you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of dollars that are affecting millions of dollars worth of decisions that a lot of business people are making? And so, yeah, partnering is awesome, but choose wisely.
And with that, I'm going to ask each of you to give me the one last thought that you want people to take away from this conference. We've talked about water quality agriculture. We've talked about partnerships. We've talked about opportunities and challenges and things like that. So just a minute or less on what's the takeaway in your mind.
Yeah. My question was, do I just know? Steve's answer was yes. So I think the important takeaway is kind of continuing the theme of partnerships, that there is a role for all of us. I mean, there is a role for the individual producer, there's a role for the crop consultants, there's a role for the producer groups, and that but an important piece of that is listening, you know, understanding each other's perspectives, understanding both the constraints and the opportunities in the world that you live in. That's something that I, as a state agency person, continually try to get better at, is both understanding what, you know, what I'm trying to accomplish, what our agency is trying to accomplish, what the state's goals are, but then trying to better understand what that means and what that looks like from a local perspective or an individual perspective. Because there's a role for all of us, but part of really realizing that vision is to both understand the opportunities and also the constraints and figure out how to play our specific roles in order to kind of move that collective picture forward.
One thought I have as we listen to all these presentations is, with all the new information and data and how we are just characterizing all of the water in Minnesota, really better understanding that very complex science, we also need to think about the human dimension and the human component of the work we're doing. A lot of things we're talking about are big changes and modifications to the way that things have been done. And when we think about change, we should think about that also a scientific approach, and there's a lot of areas of other sciences that think about human behavior and why people change their behaviors and why they adopt new practices and why they enter into partnerships that are meaningful. And so leaving some space in our very technical and biophysical science world for some of the social science to complement the work we're doing and to help us better understand this more complete picture of water in Minnesota.
Support your local conservation professional. It's something completely not earth-shattering, but all these rafts and river partnership and welfare initiative in our programs all depend upon that guy we have in rural Minnesota in a tin shed delivering these programs. And they're on the front lines, but pay them well and provide that as a career option.
This morning, there was a great question that was put to Dave from the Nature Conservancy, and was, well, what do you bring to a partnership? And I thought it was a great question because, I mean, the agronomists have relationships with the landowners that the agencies and nonprofits wish they had. And so what the TNC guy's answer was pretty good. He said, well, we've got some deep pockets on some things, we've got some technology, we've got some regional approaches that can come into play on this stuff. And I would add one more thing to that list. As a nonprofit, we get to go places that other people can't always go. I can say things an agency can't. I can get into certain rooms that an agency can't. I don't have to follow what the governor says. I can translate between agronomists and policy wonk or legislator. So I think if there's one thing I've really pulled out of the morning session on partnerships is that sometimes you need an ally that's in a slightly different field, slightly different field of endeavor than you are. And having that wide array of allies is how you kind of control your destiny a little bit better amidst a time of an awful lot of change.
Well, since the meeting of scientists, you know, I used to be one, but one thing I've come to appreciate in an area that I never did study much is, and I think it's very much neglected, is the opportunity ahead of us to use our soil resource to do more than what we think it can do now. People believe it to be just a, you know, it's treated badly in many ways, you know. I mean, if we had every landowner could understand the value of both urban and rural and have the goal of growing that resource incrementally year to year, as one of the things they think about and calculate and plan for and budget for, I think we deal with so many of these other, it is an agricultural study, mind you. We do so many other things that come along with that. We get better production, we get better water quality, we get these things that can come together if we give more attention to that. And we have a great university in the state and other states too that I know have spent more time on that than they used to. I think turning it into something that gets into people's day-to-day world is going to be really important. And we have that now with agriculture using immense data sets.
immense data set that can pinpoint that resource, you know, better than any government person can. Finding ways to get that into a business model that they have an incentive to grow the health of their soil, you know, year to year, I think would be a good thing.
What a mistake to have a climatologist go last. If somebody sees this 50 years from now gone, my message is hopefully just as relevant. We need to move forward as a community. Partnerships are extremely important. We come to meetings like this to share academic or disciplinary-based scientific knowledge, but we have a whole realm of experiential knowledge that we can only explore by partnerships and communities getting together. So I'm a big believer that I'm on the Climate Adaptation Partnership Committee for the state since 2008. Part of that is nurturing and developing a community of practitioners to adaptation and sharing all that knowledge. And in agriculture, that's going to be just as important as anything else. It's almost back to the birth of the Farmers Union, for crying out loud. We need to get all our agricultural practitioners who are coping with these issues and problems, and we need to get them, find them venues to share their experiential knowledge, to partner with state agencies, local units of government, to do things like Margaret is doing in southeastern Minnesota, but make them more broadly known and share them more broadly. We need to advance and move, keep going forward, but we need to do that as a community. That's the real important part of it, I think.
And that's going to conclude our session for the day. And if those six people sitting up there didn't give you something to think about on the way home, I don't know who's going to. So thank you very much to our panelists. Thank you to our audience. And we will be signing off. Thanks.